proceed to the fourth case, the United States versus Hill. Mr. Marzewski.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Tom Marzewski on behalf of Appellant Howard Hill on a short and simple issue of whether the trial court erred in concluding that the tax loss upon which Howard Hill was sentenced should in part be based on transactions which were not proven to be part of the conspiracy. With respect to a co-defendant who had entered a plea agreement prior to trial, Darius Bowling, the court had found that things kept moving along, but Mr. Bowling really wasn't involved with the later deals that resulted in the ultimate loss, and decided that the tax loss should be based on $65,000, which was an $18,000 tax loss, which resulted in an offense level of 11 instead of 13. And we submit that there are no differences between Mr. Bowling and Mr. Hill. The court did not incorrectly find on behalf of Mr. Bowling, at sentences. The court did not make mistakes with respect to the sentences of Mr. Bowling, as the government attempts to indicate that perhaps the district court erred in its evaluation of Mr. Bowling. But the bottom line is, Mr. Bowling and Mr. Hill both were involved to a limited extent in this conspiracy, as proven by the evidence. We would ask this court to remand to a sentence consistent with that made of Mr. Bowling. The government pointed to the testimony of Lydia Gonzalez, but Lydia Gonzalez also prepared returns under the supervision of Mr. Bowling. That's her testimony. Bowling and Hill were partners, and as the evidence indicated, Mr. Bowling delivered tax returns to Mr. Vera, and Bowling knew that the tax returns were false. However, neither Bowling or Hill knew of these second and third real estate transactions, which we submit, as was with Mr. Bowling, should not have been included in the money calculation for the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mejia?
Your Honor, my name is David Mejia, and I represent Mr. Vera. This is a case that was tried in February of 2000, a few months before the Apprendi decision. And if I may, I'll stand on the Buckman arguments and the constitutional arguments as raised, preserving them for later review, I think, which may occur in the Supreme Court in months to come. In the typical, I think, when you look to your decision in Nance, in the typical Apprendi appeal, what we see is a silent record. And we just don't have that here. What we have is an indictment that sets out in count three a specific quantity, a kilo, count two, the conspiracy charge that mentions a number of overt acts and mentions, I submit, that same kilo, December of 1995.
Does anything as a practical matter turn on this? The United States says that Hill is exposed to 130 years imprisonment, just adding up the 10 and 20 year periods and making them run consecutively, mm-hmm. as the guidelines would require.
Yes.
So what's the difference?
Well, the difference with that is that
your client doesn't expect to live 130 years, even with a 15% discount for
right.
good time.
The thing with that, Your Honor, is that that's speculation. Under the Blockberger case and under those course of conduct,
nothing speculative about it. It's what the sentencing guidelines require.
Well, but under doctrines of merger and under course of conduct and whether or not consecutive sentences could be imposed based upon the allegations charged, I don't think that that's something that can be said with clarity and beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, if you say yes, theoretically, you could add them all and run them, as we say, consecutively. It does add up to 130. But
and it's what the guidelines require.
Yeah, but the guidelines can't exceed statutory maximums. I don't think that can be used to justify.
There's no Apprendi problem. We've already held this. Other circuits have held it too. There's no Apprendi problem in running 20-year sentences consecutively until the end of the universe. provided that each sentence is the statutory maximum, 20 years.
Right. Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that's a foul of Apprendi. I think it's unconstitutional. I don't think that it's acceptable. It is theoretical, yes. Can it be done on paper? Can you add them up? Yes. Does it resolve the problem? I submit respectfully it does not. If it's a way to dispatch the case, you can do that. I submit that it's not, because whether you take it 60 or 30 or 80, whatever number of years you accumulate, it's still not life. I mean, theoretically, yes, one can't live that long, but I don't think that resolves the issue. Respectfully, I don't believe it does, Judge. If you look at those and try to attach them consecutively, are they one course of conduct? Is it proper to run? Were they out of a single act? Is it something that can survive constitutional attack? I think there's a whole lot of case law in there that says that it's a guess. It is speculation. Be that as it may, Your Honor, unless there's anything else, the point I make here, and I attempted at least to try to say, was that during the supplemental instruction conference, the question came before the court. The jury issued a letter to Judge Gettleman saying, does there have to be proof on those other acts, which I think were discussed as overt acts, but the specific quantities mentioned in count two? The judge says the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a conspiracy existed. No proof on other overt acts or quantities need be reached. The only other quantity in the case, I submit, was the single kilo, which was testified about, which was the subject of physical evidence, which was, I think, the force of the government's case by the main witness, Teresa Malone, and the jury rejected that. So it's not then speculation to say, well, had the jury been given an instruction on Apprendi, they would have found it by overwhelming evidence, because that's just not the case. As I look at the list of witnesses the government submitted to the jury in this case, all of them were witnesses who were presented and instructed by the jury to have been taken or examined with caution and care. All of them have leniency. All of them were convicted felons. All of them were self-admitted schemers in the prosecuted conspiracy. I submit that here as well, what occurred with regard to the court's post-verdict and sentencing assessment and resolution of the Apprendi question was to look to the forfeit verdict. And the problems with that were twofold. First, the determination of forfeit is by preponderance of the evidence, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The other aspect to that, of course, was that there's no quantity determination in forfeit. Forfeit deals with money. Forfeit deals with money derived from criminal activity. The decisions of Your Honors in the case of, I submit, Borkman and Brow, cited by the government, recent decisions, I think address the issue as we have it in this case on the record. In those cases, I think what they deal with, that's what occurred in Nance, a silent record. The record isn't silent here. It was brought to the attention, as I say, in post during deliberations. It was brought to the attention of the court at sentencing. With these, Your Honor, I submit that the evidence, if you apply this court's law, case law, specifically the seminal decision in Nance, it can't be said that, A, this is a silent record. It can't be said that the proof is overwhelming to justify the life sentence. In the appeal of cases brought before this and other courts, next to the death penalty, no case, I think, deserves more examination, closer scrutiny and review than a life sentence. This man, for two prior marijuana convictions for which he received probation, received a sentence of life, which Judge Gettleman believed was mandatory. I submit that under the record of the case, I submit that under the evidence and facts presented, the jury should have been instructed on that. The jury wasn't. They were specifically told not
to. You asked for an instruction. Did you ask for an instruction on that?
Trial counsel objected to the court's supplemental instruction that they need not require proof of the overt acts, that is, the one quantity mentioned in the conspiracy charge. That, I submit, is not a silent record. That is an objection. Did counsel articulate?
It's a direct objection under Shabani.
Excuse me?
Under Shabani, it's not necessary to prove any overt act in the drug conspiracy.
That's right. That's the way it was framed. But one of the overt acts.
Correct.
But one of the overt acts related to quantity. And in a pre-Apprendi context, what the trial counsel was saying was there must be proof beyond a reasonable doubt of that quantity in order to sustain the verdict.
That's wrong, both before and after Apprendi.
I'm simply saying that
the only thing that's necessary after Apprendi is a finding pertinent to sentence. And I second my colleague's question. Was such a finding ever asked for?
No. No, an objection was made to the court supplemental instruction. I submit that that preserved the issue to the extent that one could.
The argument that was made at trial was that unless the government proves quantity, the defendant can't be convicted.
Right.
That's wrong, both before and after Apprendi. There was no request for a correct instruction.
Right. Well, when one is silent, that triggers the standard applicable to plain error and Nance. This was no silence, and that's the only point I make on it. With that, Your Honors, I'll reserve what other time I have left. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mejia. Ms. Hayes?
Valerie Hayes on behalf of the United States. Appellant's counsel raised several arguments, none of which justify reversal of David Barr's or Howard Hill's convictions. In regards to the Apprendi errors, the government has two independent arguments for why these errors were harmless. One, there was overwhelming evidence of drug quantity, and two, David Barr's sentence would have been substantially the same even if the errors had not occurred. In regard to the first point, there was overwhelming evidence that David Barr's offense involved 500 grams of powder cocaine, the minimum necessary to justify a life sentence under count two. When there's overwhelming evidence of drug quantity, failure to submit the issue of drug quantity to the jury is harmless because the jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. The evidence in this case of 500 grams was overwhelming because the government actually introduced evidence at trial that David Barr's offense involved over 150 kilograms of cocaine. The government just had to show that David Barr's offense involved one half of a kilogram. Furthermore, the district court, who heard all the evidence in this case and had the opportunity to assess the credibility of the witnesses, found that David Barr's offense involved 150 kilograms. In fact, the district court explicitly stated during sentencing that the evidence of 500 grams was overwhelming. Furthermore, the jury found by preponderance of the evidence that David Barr should forfeit over $1 million worth of assets as drug trafficking proceeds. Now, evidence was introduced at trial that David Barr received between $1,000 and $2,000 in profits per kilogram sold. Now, if the jury found by preponderance of the evidence that he acquired over $1 million in assets from drug profits, it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that they would have found 500 grams. In regards to count three, appellant's counsel mentioned the fact that David Barr wasn't convicted on count three, which dealt with only one specific drug transaction. And just because the jury did not find beyond a reasonable doubt on that 1 kilogram in that transaction doesn't mean they wouldn't have found 500 grams with totaling in the conspiracy, the forfeiture verdict for one suggests otherwise. As the appellant's counsel mentioned, in terms of the instruction, they never asked for specific instruction on drug quantity during the trial. They asked for an instruction that all the paragraphs in the indictment in count two be proven. In regards to the second reason the Apprendi errors were harmless, the district court could have stacked the sentences and reached 130 years, and there's no substantial difference between a sentence of 130 years and a life sentence.
At least in the current state of medicine.
In the current state with no parole and good time credit not making a difference in the
case. No, I was referring to the current state of medical knowledge, not of law.
Right.
130 years could turn out to be less than life if advances continue.
David Barr would have to live to be about 150 years old. I'm going to move on and talk briefly about David Barr's forfeiture arguments. First, Apprendi doesn't apply to forfeiture because the forfeiture statute has no graduated maximums. In regards to the district court relying on the forfeiture verdict, it did not improperly rely upon the forfeiture verdict. The district court relied on its finding that the evidence of 500 grams was overwhelming. The district court just then mentioned in passing that the jury's forfeiture verdict suggested that the jury agreed with the decision. In regard to Howard Hill's arguments, the district court properly included the Kyler Street and Mozart Street property transactions in its sentencing calculations. There was evidence presented at trial that Howard Hill was directly involved in these transactions, specifically his employees, either after receiving approval or a direct order from Hill, created the fraudulent documents that David Barr used to create or to purchase the properties. Now, Bowling, appellant's counsel mentioned that Gonzalez was under Bowling's supervision, but again, he never gave specific approval or a direct order, unlike Howard Hill. And the $24,000 cashier's check used in the Division Street property was properly included because it was drug proceeds and unreported income. The government respectfully requests that this court affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Marzuski? All right. Mr. Mejia?
I think the record supports the position of the appellant that at the sentencing, at the time of sentencing, the government urged repeatedly, look to the jury's forfeit. Look to the jury's verdict on forfeit. Look to the dollar amount. That proves quantity. Earlier, however, when it came time during supplemental instructions, the government said, we don't have to prove quantity. We don't need to prove quantity. Quantity need not be proven. And the court so instructed the jury. On appeal now, of course, the government says, we prove quantity by overwhelming evidence. I think the word overwhelming in their brief is probably repeated about 8 times. Saying overwhelming, repeating the word overwhelming doesn't make it so. The one juncture in the case where the jury was confronted with any quantity was the kilo, and they rejected it. The person that calculated and added up this so-called 150 kilos was Teresa Malone. She testified there were 200 transactions, so many kilos each. He did them all. The jury rejected her. The jury had difficulties with this case. The jury asked the court during deliberations, does the government need to prove those things, the overt act set forth in count one, obviously indicating some doubt about this. Now, in order to say, well, let's look to the forfeit, let's look to the dollar amount, and that proves quantity, I submit is wrong for 2 reasons. Number one, it's by proof, by preponderance of the evidence, and two, there's no quantity submitted on that. And the government says the judge didn't take it into account. Well, he did. He did because he says so in the record, that the jury's indications of its forfeit indicates quantity by overwhelming evidence. It was only then, at the very end of the case then, that the government says, we proved quantity. We prove it by overwhelming evidence. Not by a verdict because we didn't want one. Not by an instruction because we objected to one. Not by any kind of verdict because we didn't want a verdict on quantity. We simply want the three of you to say it was overwhelming and leave it at that. Run him out, have him serve his life because we all say overwhelming 6 or 8 times. I submit the proof wasn't there of it. If it was, that it had a verdict on it. The one person who calculated quantity was Teresa Malone. They didn't believe her. And when the jury doesn't believe her, I submit it would be unfair for your honors to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mahan. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court will